Good afternoon and welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and integrated health. The rates of autism among young children has risen and continues to rise. A massive study done in California alone showed increases between 1987 and 1998, ranging between 273% and 346%, depending on which definition of autism was used. So reports today's guest, Dr. Bernard Rimlin, in an editorial published in the Journal of Nutritional and Environmental Medicine in 2000. With this staggering increase of cases reported, why are environmental causes, such as the neurotoxic effects of mercury and other metals, some of them from childhood vaccinations, and the latest research on several nutritional interventions, which have had remarkable results with no harmful side effects, still being largely ignored? Join us today for a discussion of the biological foundation of autism and other related disorders. Dr. Bernard Rimlin, which is spelled R-I-M-L-A-N, like it sounds, Rimland. Dr. Bernard Rimlin, a research psychologist who is interrupting my intro, is director of the autism. He's not autistic. See, this is now we've described what autism is. The opposite here. He is director of the Autism Research Institute, which he founded in 1967. He's also the founder of the Autism Society of America and the editor of the Autism Research Review International. His prize-winning book, Infantile Autism, The Syndrome and Its Implications for a Neural Theory of Behavior from 1964, changed the field of psychiatry from claiming that autism is an emotional illness caused by destructive mothers to its current recognition that autism is a biological disorder. Dr. Rimlin is a co-founder of the Defeat Autism Now project, which proposes to reorient mainstream medicine from its current over-reliance on marginally effective drugs toward a new emphasis on identifying and treating the basic biological causes of autism. He has lectured on autism and other related problems throughout the world, and he is the author of numerous publications. Dr. Rimlin has received many awards for his work on autism, and he served as primary technical advisor on autism for the film The Rain Man with Dustin Hoffman. So thank you again for making yourself available.
Glad to be with you.
It might be, joking aside, important for our listeners for you to just explain, in case some of the people are uninitiated, what the symptoms of autism are and how it's possibly diagnosed.
Well, the word diagnosed is sort of a...
loose.
Pardon?
It's a loose term in this case.
Yes. I tell people when they tell me their child has been diagnosed as autistic, I tell them their child has been labeled autistic. The word diagnostic or diagnosed seems to have a sort of a technical air about it, which is pretentious, because there are really no good means of diagnosing the condition. But, you know, really you can label children who show some of the symptoms or many of the symptoms. Formerly, when my son was born 46 years ago, the vast majority of autistic children were born with a peculiar inability to relate to people. Even when the mother tried to pick the child up for the first time, the child would not cuddle or hug or kind of snuggle in the way normal kids do. They don't reach out for the parents. So you could tell something was wrong with the child right at the outset. In the past 15 or 20 years, the situation has changed quite dramatically, so that the vast majority, three-quarters at least, of the autistic kids who are called autistic today are normal for the first 15 or 18 months, and then the autism sets in. One of the things that the medical establishment claims is that autism typically starts at 18 months, and that's when some of the vaccines are given, so the parents are accused of erroneously concluding that the vaccines cause the autism, but actually for many decades, autism did not start at 18 months, but started at birth. However, back to your request for sort of a description of autism, the kids don't relate to people in the ordinary way. They don't look at people. They don't even recognize their parents as such frequently. They regard others as being more or less inanimate objects. Their speech is usually either they're mute, don't talk at all, or their speech is very stilted and not very communicative. They engage in ritualistic sort of rocking behaviors or self-stimulating behaviors, sometimes for hours at a time. They don't seem to be able to pay attention to anything other than whatever it is that happens to stimulate their curiosity at the moment. Maybe a rock or a flashlight battery or whatever, and they'll just spend hours playing with that, ignoring the people and even the pets around them while they just have these fascination with objects. There's a whole variety of symptoms that are used to characterize the autistic child, but I think the word autistic itself tells you a lot about what the conditions are. Autistic comes from the Greek word autos, meaning self. It seems as though these kids are self-involved, self-absorbed, rather than being tied in with the normal world, especially the social world around them. So that's nutshell. It's a very large nutshell, but that's a brief description.
But, you know, I can see how it could have been erroneously pegged as an emotional disorder, because you're looking at a child in an extreme, it's an extreme case of withdrawal, more or less. These are very isolated individuals. They're not perceiving the external world as being part of their existence somehow. So there's something very sad about this. And I was reminded when I was looking at your materials that you had a child born like this to your own family and have had remarkable success in making him someone who participates in the world, and he's an illustrator and he's had a children's book published. So although he still lives with you, I believe.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So this was something that was very personal for you.
Very much so. I had never heard the word autism, never seen such a child. Our son was born 3 years after I had earned a PhD in psychology, and I can assure you that the word autism was never in any of the textbooks, any of the classes that I attended. It was totally new. Our pediatrician, who had been in practice for 35 years at that time, had never seen or heard of an autistic child. Our son Mark was as much a mystery to him as it was to us. It wasn't until Mark was 2 years old that his mother remembered reading in one of her college textbooks about a child who just wandered around the house aimlessly, repeating nursery rhymes and radio commercials, having no relationship with other people. When he wanted something, he would grab us by the hand, as though we were a mechanical tong of some sort, and take us to whatever he wanted, the refrigerator door or whatever, and so sort of use us as tools rather than as people.
Mm.
So those were very strange times. All the textbooks, the psychiatry, child psychiatry textbooks, said it was an emotional disorder brought about by the mother's dislike of the child, which the child somehow picked up and decided to sort of withdraw from the world. By the way, there's a mother of an autistic child, J.J. Hanley, has produced for PBS television a very wonderful documentary which goes into the history of autism and this idea of blaming the mothers. Now, that's going to be shown on PBS, I think in May. I'm not sure. I should have gotten the date. But anyway, it's called The Refrigerator Mothers. They were called refrigerator mothers because they were supposed to be so cold and unfeeling, they were just like refrigerators. So anyway, if your listeners are also viewers, is it okay to mention television on the radio?
Sure.
I don't know what's verboten. But it is
that's
a
fine.
PBS.
So we should look for it on PBS.
Yes, it's for the refrigerator mothers, and it should be quite interesting.
Okay, so the other thing that struck me as we're going to get into a variety of things in terms of covering the subject, we're going to talk about conventional treatments versus, the nutritional interventions. We're going to talk about different research that's come out about the nutritional interventions. We're going to talk about food intolerances and some other therapies that work with this. And there's going to be a political undertone. But before we get into that, it seems to me that autism, as I read about it, or as I understand some of the potential nutrient deficiencies that seem to disrupt the brain patterns of these children, that there must be related conditions, that there must be some way in which possibly other loose diagnoses like ADD, some of these other attention deficit disorders, some of these other hyperactive children may also link in somewhere. Am I right?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, nowadays, the term that's most frequently used, and I think appropriately, is the child is on the autistic spectrum. And the spectrum ranges from individuals who are just severely, starkly autistic with hardly any recognition or acknowledgement of other people, all the way to people who are including ADHD people and so forth. Some quite well-known people, like Bill Gates, for example, has been mentioned in, I guess it was Newsweek magazine, as exhibiting quite a number of symptoms of autism, you know, sort of a fascination with, you know, with numbers and objects and so forth, and not being terribly skilled at interpersonal relations. A recently published book called Diagnosing Jefferson, by the father of an autistic child, an historian named Legend, I forget his first name, it goes into rather convincing detail about the possibility that Jefferson was a high-functioning person, or high-functioning autistic, or a normal person with a lot of high-functioning autistic characteristics.
Well, I would also think that there are some other tie-ins here, because my impression is, as I study more about these various disorders that people are labeling, is that people can have low levels or tendencies in this direction. In other words, you can be from a family where there is a schizophrenic and have slightly schizoid tendencies without being a full-blown schizophrenic. And having schizoid tendency doesn't mean that you don't function well. In fact, one of the things that Robert Sapolsky talks about in his research is that somebody that's like that would maybe be someone who's very interested in magic, for instance. They don't actually hear voices. And the same thing with OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorders, or Tourette's. People can have, I think, a slight tendency in that direction. And what it makes me think is that many people are suffering from some disruption in the way that nutrients and the brain are interacting. One of the things that you discovered in your research is that there were different nutrients, specifically I'm thinking B6 here, that were not being maintained properly in the body, that there was a deficiency. Am I understanding this right, or is it that they were inappropriately urinating it out, or they were losing their concentrations of B6? They don't...
Well, no one knows the exact mechanism, which accounts for the fact that many autistic children and adults do very well on massive doses of B6.
Yeah.
We are going to be having a think tank later this year, probably in early July, where we'll be calling together a number of experts on metabolism, particularly with regard to vitamin B6, to see if we can figure out what it is. I think it's not a deficiency of B6. They have just as much B6 in their diet as ordinary kids, or they may have more. In fact, but their metabolism, they've got a metabolic error, perhaps for a genetic reason or some other reason, metabolic error which makes it mandatory. They may need 500 times as much B6 as a normal person needs. It's one theory is that they cannot convert the pyridoxal hydrochloride form of B6, which they get in foods, to the pyridoxal 5-phosphate form, which is the active form that the body uses.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
I might add, just you mentioned this phenomenon of people having smaller amounts of these different disorders. There is an extremely good book on that very subject. It's called The Shadow Syndromes. The Shadow Syndromes by John Ratey, R-A-T-E-Y, and Katherine Johnson, and she goes into just exactly the ideas that you expressed, that so-called normal people have vestigial levels of a lot of the traits of diagnosable disorders, such as autism, schizophrenia, depression, manic depression, and so forth, OCD.
So it's called The Shadow Syndromes, and the author's name again is
R-A-T-E-Y,
okay,
and Johnson.
Okay. Yeah, I think that I sense that that's true. I'll have to get the book.
I found myself in that book.
Well, I found myself in myself in a lot of that research, and I see it in my family too. Yeah. I see it in my parents. So I mean, I know that there's some, and I'm not saying full blown, you know, but small tendencies. You start to observe and you start to see it. I see it in people come to me for consultations too.
Actually, a psychiatrist who used to be in Berkeley, he's now in Massachusetts, so he may come back to Berkeley. Michael Lesser has just a couple of months ago published a book called The Brain Chemistry Diet, in which he renames all of the different conditions like schizophrenia. He renames them the dreamer, the lover, the warrior, and so forth, and he points to the positive traits which small amounts of that particular biochemical abnormality in the brain confers to individuals who happen to have that type of constitution. The more severe forms, of course, are, you know, pretty bad to have. But he points out it, with the brain chemistry diet that, and he talks about dietary means of, you know, of helping such individuals.
Right.
The smaller amounts are beneficial in various ways.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Dr. Bernard Rimland. It's Rimland. And we're talking about autism and related disorders. So why don't we talk a bit about megavitamin therapy and how many are helped and how long, you know, and what they are. And you talked first here about this vitamin B6, that there's a faulty mechanism. And so that people can take these very large doses of B6. B6 is famous for having a it's a non-toxic reaction, but it's uncomfortable. In some cases, if people take large doses of it, they can develop peripheral neuropathy where they feel some tingling or numbness. What you discovered is that if you take B6 with magnesium, this doesn't happen. So what kinds of doses of B6 are we talking about, and what kinds of doses of magnesium?
Well, for autistic individuals, the average dose that brings about a good effect is about 8 milligrams of B6 per pound of body weight, so that a person who weighs 100 pounds would be taking about 800 milligrams of vitamin B6 and about half or a third that much of magnesium, maybe, you know, 300 or so milligrams of magnesium per day. Now, the RDA, recommended dietary allowance for B6, what the federal government and other supposed authorities claim is what the average person needs is about 1.5 milligrams a day of B6.
Yeah, but the RDA, I mean, I've done shows where this has been discussed, but the way that these numbers were arrived at is pretty arbitrary.
I have no respect, or very little respect, for those numbers. But just as a lot of vitamin products, off-the-shelf vitamin products, you know, have those amounts in them because that's, you know, they can point to the federal guidelines. But anyway, 1.5 or 2 or in that ballpark are what the supposed authorities claim is necessary. So you can see that 800 or 1,000 milligrams of E6 is considerably in excess of that. I must say that only about 46-47% of autistic individuals, and we have data on over 5,000 autistic individuals who tried high dose of B6, only about 46-47% respond positively to it. It's not every case, but it's almost every, I mean, it's about half the cases that respond. But if you do respond, the average amount is about 8 milligrams per pound of body weight of B6, and about a little bit less than half of that of magnesium. The magnesium is necessary in order for the B6 to have its full effect on the body. Not only will you get some side effects, as you indicated a few moments ago, of the B6 unless you have the magnesium present. Side effects include jitteriness and irritability and things of that sort, but you will not get the benefits of the B6. We have lots of cases who've tried B6 alone or magnesium alone. They do not get anywhere near the beneficial effect that they get if they put the B6 and magnesium together, because the B6 and magnesium act as a team within the body. You take a lot of B6 and there's insufficient magnesium available, the B6 can't do its work, and the same is true with taking a lot of magnesium without the B6. So you need the combination.
Well, and in addition, I think you need the concert of the other players, too, a multivitamin, at the very least a multivitamin,
yes.
Or a B-complex and some additional other vitamins as well and minerals.
When I sent you the package of information, I faxed it to you a while ago, I don't believe I faxed you a very important document that I should have, and that was a paper that was published way back in 1979 by Dr. Mary Coleman and some of her associates comparing vitamin B6 with Ritalin in a group of hyperactive boys who already were known to respond favorably to Ritalin, so the Ritalin had one leg up to begin with. Nevertheless, the high-dose B6 was at least as good as the Ritalin and actually better in some respects because it was longer-lasting, safer, and much less expensive.
I think before we go on to some of the other nutritive interventions, since we've started to talk about that and it's coming up, what are the conventional treatments? What are they like? And what is their success versus their potential harm?
You're referring now to autism?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the traditional treatments used to be play therapy, where the children were given a paper doll or a piece of clay and were told, this is your mother, tear the head off, you know. The idea was that the child would be encouraged to express hostility against the mother in that way, supposedly. It would cure the autism. It's just sheer gibberish, but that was seriously what was practiced for decades. My autism book, published in '64, destroyed that idea, I'm very, very glad to say, so the mothers aren't blamed anymore for their having caused the kids' autism. But anyway, the treatments at that time, as they say, were primarily play therapy and drugs. Most physicians that you take an autistic kid to today will be given various drugs. Ritalin is the most commonly used drug for autism, and it makes most autistic children worse rather than better. It's ridiculous, even though many autistic kids are hyperactive, and Ritalin is used for hyperactivity. It certainly does not help, and it makes autistic kids worse. There are other drugs, too. Antidepressants are commonly used. Their success rate is very poor in terms of improving the condition, and they also bring about a lot of side effects, like weight gain, for example, or constipation, or just a whole variety of physical problems that the child really doesn't need. So the traditional treatments for autism are awful.
Yeah, I see the you gave me a chart with the various drugs that are used, quite a considerable number of them here.
Yes.
Frightening, actually.
Take a look at Ritalin, and they're alphabetically arranged. You can see Ritalin was by far the most used drug. I think it was 3,500 cases we had there. And as I recall, the numbers was like 46% of the kids get worse, and only 43% get worse, is it, and about 25 or so get better. So there's about twice as many kids get worse as get better on Ritalin. Is that?
Yeah, that's close. I mean, I can't, the part where I think it's 27, it's 44%. Get worse.
Yeah,
27% get no effect at all, and 28% get better.
Yeah, so it's close to a 2-to-1 ratio, getting worse to getting better, which is really awful.
Really, none of them are doing very well. In
fact, at that time, risperidol had the best record, and it doesn't begin to compare with vitamin B6 in terms of the number of kids improved.
Yeah, because you've got, down below, you have nutrient supplements and diet changes, and the amount of people that get worse are like 2%, 3%. And then the dietary changes, where you change the diet, it's like 1% gets worse. And then it's like 58% get better, you know, or 55% get better.
As a matter of fact, just last night at about midnight, we finished the updated version of that chart.
Yeah.
There's many more drugs. I'll be very happy to send that chart and a bunch of other literature on our work on B6 and so forth to any of your readers who wish to write to us. May I?
Yes, please do.
Provide an address.
Yes.
They can write to ARI, which stands for Autism Research Institute. If they're ambitious, they can write the whole thing out. But all they need to write is ARI, 4182 Adams Avenue, ADAMS Avenue, San Diego, California, 92116. We also, that's 4182 Adams, San Diego, 92116. We also have a website, the address of which is www.autismresearchinstitute.com. And a lot of that information is on there.
Did you want people to send you a self-addressed stamped envelope to send it back in?
No, because...
They send the wrong size.
No, well, oh. we send them about 6 ounces of material.
Ah.
So if they would send us a small donation, that would be helpful.
That would be nice.
A large donation,
yeah.
Even better.
Yeah.
But our information packages are free.
Okay.
But an ordinary business-sized envelope wouldn't begin to carry the.
All right. So let's say that if people want, you'll send them in either case. But if people have the means to send you a check for anything that they can contribute,
yes.
And then you'll send a very large information package back to them. It's ARI. 4182 Adams Avenue, San Diego, 92116. We're going to have to take a brief break in a moment here. When we come back, we're going to continue our discussion with Dr. Bernard Rimland, R-I-M-L-A-N-D, Ph.D. What I want to go over is to talk a little bit about some of the battles that you've had to fight because there's so much resistance to using nutritional interventions, and some of the study that you've done, and other studies you've done, and then go back over the rest of the vitamin therapies and talk about food intolerances. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Dr. Bernard Rimland, and we will be back in about 30 seconds. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. I am on the phone with Dr. Bernard Rimland, R-I-M-L-A-N-D. He's given out an address for the Autism Research Institute, which you can send a small donation to help with the mailing. He's going to send you an enormous package full of information. It goes to 4182 Adams Avenue, San Diego, 92116. We've been talking about some of the various megavitamin therapies. The B6 and the magnesium is one of the early ones that's been used that was very promising. But economics aside, which is a big aside because there's all these drug companies, why has there been so much resistance to using nutritional interventions?
Well, I think it's first. It's really hard to know. You know, if you look at the history of nutrition, long before there were drug companies, there was resistance. For example, it was discovered, in the, I think, 1600s, that if you carried lime juice on board ships, to get some vitamin C, that you could prevent scurvy. Scurvy was a hideous problem in those days. Hundreds of thousands of sailors died on board ship. They would just keel over and die, and the ship would be found floating, years later with no one on board. It was
supposed to be why they came up with the term limey.
Yeah.
That they had to carry limes.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the man who did the study waited for 20 years before the British merchant marine began carrying limes. Tens of thousands of people died in the meantime. The British Admiralty, the military part of the Navy, didn't do it for about 60 years. The same thing happened with the Japanese Navy. They had beriberi, which was a hideous nerve disease brought about by a shortage of vitamin B1. And a study was done, I think Admiral Yamamoto did it in about 1900 or so, did a study where on some ships they had brown rice, which had the B1. Of course, he didn't know about the B1, but he found that the brown rice prevented this disease. The white rice did not prevent it. And it took him, the Japanese, a terribly long time before they would finally agree that this nutritional deficiency was at the root of beriberi. It's just been pellagra is another disease. And this is before there were drugs available. So it's not just the drug company profiteering causes so much hostility toward vitamins. The medical establishment had that antipathy toward vitamins long before the drug companies existed.
Yeah, and you know, I think that part of it has to do with something that we've talked about on the show when we've had Kenny Ossibel as a guest, who is author of When Healing Becomes a Crime, about Harry Hoxie's cancer treatments, is that early on, during the Industrial Revolution or so, around that time, there was a split between medical treatments that relied on nature, who supported nature, you know, the empiric kind of style, split off, and there was this heroic intervention style, which was very anti-nature, which involved using heavy metals and poisons and bleedings and all these very aggressive interventions that often killed patients. And it's that split where you have this heroic intervention that's kind of the root of conventional Western medicine. That isn't to say that Western medicine doesn't have a place, but there is this split of hostility toward anything that's quote-unquote natural. The other thing is that there's always, when vitamins started to be studied as individual nutrients, there was a lot of emphasis on the study. So a lot of studies were done early in the 40s and 50s that were very, very promising, and then drugs began to be developed, and that was the end of that.
Well, you know, you reminded me of two things. One, someone in an audience where I was giving a talk, someone in the audience said, you know, that's the same question you did. You know, why is there so much hostility toward the use of vitamins? And I gave, you know, the answer that I gave you. And someone else in the audience piped up with a very good response. I said, how about this for an answer? If you're not up on something, you're down on it.
Oh, boy, that's a good answer.
I thought that was excellent.
Yeah.
I also want to mention the use of folic acid, which is an extremely safe B vitamin, as a means of treating, preventing neural tube defects.
Right.
In the brain, in the absence of the brain, anencephaly in newborns. A horrible disease. About 25,000 people a year are are injured with this vitamin deficiency. A man called Smithles over in England discovered, I think it was about in the 1960s, that women who were taking folic acid supplements, not massive amounts, just ordinary amounts, just about 400 micrograms a day, which is, you know, a trivial amount almost, but they had 1/6 the number, as I recall, of these, severely retarded children, as did mothers who did not take the supplements. Yet it took about 30 years before the medical establishment finally agreed to, suggest that the pregnant women start taking this vitamin. Now, to take it would have cost, you know, less than a penny a day, absolutely no danger involved, would have saved, a million children from being retarded, and yet there was this horrible resistance to doing it that had to be overcome by study after study after study. Finally, the evidence became so totally overwhelming that they reluctantly agreed to make the fortification of foods with folic acid.
Yeah, it's one of the success stories.
But it's just a horrible example of what you're talking about.
Incidentally, I neglected to say to people at the coming back from the end of the break that if you want to get a copy of this or any other show in the series Your Own Health and Fitness, cassette copies are available, and you can call my information number at 707-874-2772 24 hours a day to get that information. You had quite a fight on your hands when you started to experiment with B6, and you had done some studies, and there was an argument about whether they would be recognized by the institutions, the medical institutions. So you did a big study. You did a very traditional study. You want to talk about the study you did?
Well, actually, we've done several studies.
Yeah.
The one that you're referring to, I think that was done with the University of California Medical School. A friend of mine who was director of research at that time, psychiatric research, and I were having a bit of a friendly quarrel. I was chiding him because I thought his psychiatric friends were bigots for neglecting this strong evidence that vitamin B6 helped autistic children. There were a number of studies even at that time. And he said, oh, the studies aren't really very good, and they're not published in the kinds of journals that my colleagues respect, so let's us do a totally airtight study. You know, that no one could possibly object to. We will cover every base. We'll do the most airtight study ever done. We'll get the government funding for it, and we can do the study. And I said, I don't think it'll make any difference. Your friends are a bunch of bigots. They don't care how many studies are done. He said, no, that's not true, he said. So we went ahead and did the study. The results were positive, much to his surprise. He thought that the previous good results must have been a quirk or cheating or something, but by golly, with this totally airtight study, it still came out positive. He submitted the study to the American Journal of Psychiatry, which turned it down, and he wrote them an infuriated letter saying that the reason he had done the study, the most airtight study anyone had ever designed, every possible, you know, loose connection was checked on. They finally published it, so it was published in the American Journal of Psychiatry. Nevertheless, all the textbooks continue to this day to say, including federal government publications, that vitamins don't help autistic children.
Yeah.
It's just an outright lie.
Yeah.
There have been 18 consecutive studies done by researchers in 6 countries, including 6 double-blind placebo-controlled studies, the gold standard of these kinds of designs. 11 double-blind placebo-controlled studies plus 18 total studies, every one of which shows positive results, and the textbooks still lie and say there's no evidence. It's just amazing.
I know it is. What kind of magnesium do you find it matters what kind of magnesium people use in conjunction with B6?
Well, it doesn't seem to. The kind that is most often used is magnesium oxide,
uh-huh.
which is not the best form of B6 because it's
magnesium
oxide.
Yeah.
It's very good because it's inexpensive, and it's got a lot of magnesium per unit volume. Each gram of magnesium oxide contains a lot. Now the best forms are things like magnesium gluconate or magnesium citrate.
Citrate is good, yeah.
Citrate is very good, but mm-hmm. much more expensive. You have to take a lot more of it in order to get the benefit.
Yeah, and then magnesium. It's worth mentioning that magnesium is a cathartic. So if you end up taking more magnesium than you need, like if you load up, you'll get a little crampy and maybe get a little bit of the runs. You just back off on your dose and it goes away.
You know, the most important cause of heart attacks.
Yep.
Is magnesium.
Lack of magnesium and lack of potassium.
And particularly the magnesium.
Yeah, because it opens the venous blood flow. It dilates the vessels.
Yeah.
Helps with asthma.
Everyone in this country who is not taking magnesium in every country is making a big mistake.
Yeah.
Big mistake.
Yeah. It's very good for the lungs also.
First heart attacks are fatal.
Yep. That's right.
You're playing a Russian roulette with your health.
Exactly.
If you don't take magnesium supplements.
That's right. And everybody loads up on calcium and forgets about magnesium. The dimethylglycine. Now, this is really interesting because I know that trimethylglycine is helping people to protect them from homocysteine, which is this people who have a tendency to produce too much homocysteine in response to a meal that's high in methionine, one of the amino acids, will produce an abundance of homocysteine, and that can lead to early heart attacks. And folic acid helps, and B vitamins help, but so does trimethylglycine. Why dimethyl? What's the difference between the two? And maybe you should explain what it is for people that don't know.
Well, dimethylglycine, DMG, as it's abbreviated, DMG, many health food stores carry it. Many don't, which kind of surprises me because it's an extremely valuable...
Yeah, it's even harder to find trimethyl.
Yes, trimethyl is even harder to find. Theoretically, trimethyl is better. But in terms of actual research experience, in my experience, the DMG is better. The analysis I told you about that we just finished last night on quite a few hundred cases of both with DMG and TMG, the autistic children do better on DMG than they do on TMG. But DMG was formerly called vitamin B15. It was discovered in the U.S. by a man in San Francisco, as a matter of fact. But there was no interest in the U.S. in pursuing it because you can't make any money on a vitamin. At least in those days you couldn't. No one was interested in vitamins. But the Russians did an enormous amount of research on what they called pangamic acid or calcium pangamate. They were giving it to their Olympic athletes, to their military personnel. I have a file drawer full of Russian research during the Cold War, on DMG. But the FDA did not like it to be called a vitamin. They objected to the term vitamin B15, and they started suing companies that were selling it under that label. So the judge concluded with the FDA that it wasn't a vitamin. There are 5 criteria, which I won't go into at the moment, for what's a vitamin. And the B15 met 4 of the 5, but not the fifth. Well, the fifth is that you have to show overt signs of a deficiency of some sort, like scurvy for vitamin C, or beriberi for vitamin B1, or plaguer for vitamin B3, and so forth. There are no such signs for a deficiency of B15, so they said it must not be a vitamin. However, it's found in the same foods that the B vitamins are found in. The chemical composition is very similar to that of the B vitamins. Its functions are very similar to that of the B vitamins. And so I think that it really is a vitamin.
Well, glycine is an amino acid, and it's one that's around a lot. There's a lot of glycine around, but glycine itself is very good for chelating out metals, which
yes.
makes sense, because as we'll find out later here and soon, I hope, in the show, that metals may be a key to this. But methylation is a metabolic, isn't it? Metabolic? Yeah, it's a metabolic, it's something that happens as your metabolic, it's a process that you go through in the body, methylation. So this is already methylated, and di means two, I think, and tri is three. So
there are some differences between the two substances, but the amount of research that's been done on dimethylglycine, I told you about the Russian research, is tremendous. It affects so many systems of the body. It has huge benefits to the immune system. It has tremendous benefits to your lactic acid concentration. So athletes take it.
Lowers lactic acid.
Yeah, Gary Noll told me that he's a New York.
No, we know who Gary Noll is.
Okay, a person who's also a marathoner, and he tells me that that the marathoners take often, some of them take a 125 milligram tablet of DMG every mile they run, 26 tablets in a marathon, and the next they run faster. They don't cramp. The next day they feel better. They don't have all the aches and pains, and race horses run faster. Humans run faster.
So DMG rather than trimethyl.
Yes,
than
yes. Now the TMG may also have some of those benefits.
Yeah.
I don't know, but
yeah.
I do have a tremendous amount of literature on DMG.
Okay.
I might say that the Russians have done some horrible studies on dogs and rats.
Mm.
What they've done, you take a rat and you put it, you put it in a test tube so there's no air getting into it.
No, I don't think you want to describe something really vicious to animals on this show, because I don't like hearing it, but also I think the audience is offended when they hear it.
The point is that the amount of oxygen that a person is able to survive on, or an animal or whatever,
goes down.
You can survive better. So if you have a stroke or something where the oxygen content of your brain is reduced, you have a much better chance of survival if you've been taking DMG.
Well, and that brings up other issues, because oxidation in the body is good, but it also can cause problems. I mean, you can create free radicals, and there's oxidative damage and stuff that occurs from over-oxidation. It's a very tricky line between enough and too much. So if you lower the oxygen need, presumably that would be protective in terms of free radical production.
DMG is considered to be non-toxic. People
absolutely, have, sure.
So that the oxidative damage...
No, I'm saying it's the other way around. I'm saying it would protect you from that if you're lowering the amount of oxygen that you're needing. Anyway, maybe I'm going on too much of an offshoot.
In any event, it's a very, very safe substance.
No, I get that. I mean, glycine is in everything. It's all over the place. But
I tell parents they want to know how much is too much. And I say, as far as I know, about the only way you can hurt someone with DMG is to drop a barrel of it on their kid's head from a high point.
Yeah. So what doses are you suggesting people start with for children?
Well, we don't really know the dosage levels of DMG the way we do for B6, but I know mothers of 3.5-year-olds who are giving their kids 15 a day. I'm not recommending that much.
15,000 milligrams?
No, 15 of those 125 milligram tablets a day. DMG has the remarkable ability to stop seizures in some individuals who have seizures that are not controlled by anticonvulsants.
So it might work for epileptics as well?
It works for epileptics and many epileptics. I know of some cases where the individual would be on four anticonvulsive drugs at the same time and still have seizures. They were put on the DMG and the seizures stopped. I know of children who did not ever speak, children 3-4 years of age. They were given DMG and the next day they began using words for the first time.
And what percentage of cases is this working in? Same thing, about 40-50%?
It's just a little bit less than the B6 magnesium.
Okay. Before we go on to secretion, since that's kind of a new player, let's talk, because we're getting low on time, let's talk about, oh, and I should mention again, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. We're on the phone. I'm Lena Berman. I have Dr. Bernard Rimland, R-I-M-L-A-N-D, Ph.D., on the phone. If you want an information packet from his organization, the Autistic Research Institute, send a little donation plus
a large donation.
huge donation.
Either one's fine.
To ARI, 4182 Adams Avenue, San Diego, 92116. They will send you an information package without a donation. They just really could use the donation. Food intolerance is very interesting with autism. Gluten, casein, milk, wheat. It's also important, I think, for people to remember that casein, which is in milk, and other things are in milk, but in gluten, it's not just wheat. There are other grains, and soy, which has gluten in it as well. Do you want to talk about that?
Well,
about gluten and casein?
Yes, a large percentage, in fact, I'm really quite surprised at how large the percentage is. No one knows for sure what it is, but it's the number of percentage of kids who try it seems to be, try this diet, or his parents try the diet, seems to be increasing all the time. I spoke with a mother recently in Montana that said about two-thirds to three-quarters of all the mothers in her support group had tried this gluten-casein-free diet, a wheat and milk-free diet largely, have seen improvement, marked improvement in their kids. I've been recommending that parents try this ever since the 1960s. I won't go into all those little stories that I used to hear, but many, many parents would tell me that their kids, when they put them on a milk-free diet and a wheat-free diet, gluten-free diet, the kids would show improvement. And that is really, in fact, I think the number of such kids who are improving nowadays is greater than before, partly due to the fact that the increase in autism that we spoke about at the very beginning of this program causes the kids to become more gluten and casein sensitive. The vaccine damage, we haven't gotten very much into that.
We're going to,
but the vaccines, especially the mercury in the vaccines, chew up the intestinal tract so that peptides, little molecules that are found in foods, especially the casein and gluten molecules, peptides from them, get into the bloodstream and interfere with brain functioning.
That's right.
And as the vaccines, and particularly the mercury in the vaccines, destroy the gut lining, more and more of those substances, which the intestinal tract is supposed to filter out of the blood, keep it out of the blood, you get what's called leaky gut syndrome, and these abnormal toxic neurotoxic substances get into the brain, the bloodstream in the brain, and the kid becomes autistic.
The single most useful thing I have seen work as an intervention, and a very low, non-invasive intervention that always works with people who are having any kind of disturbing psychological symptoms, psychiatric symptoms, physical symptoms, is to put them on a low allergen diet, on a pre-agrarian, an allergy diet that avoids a lot of the foods that showed up after we started raising foods with farm. I see this work over and over with children and adults.
Why are you not calling it the caveman diet? Is that?
Well, I do call it that sometimes. Sometimes I call it a Paleolithic diet. Sometimes I call it a hunter-gather diet.
But the easiest to remember is the
We used to call it the caveman diet, but then you have to call it cave person now.
Yeah,
really
cave person.
So I think hunter-gather probably works. You're doing some work with a laboratory called Kirkman Labs, K-I-R-K-M-A-N. And they have a website, KirkmanLabs, all one word, .com, because as parents will report, it's very hard to control what children eat when they're not under their nose. And the problem with these children who are food sensitive is that a tiny little bit of something will throw them completely out of whack. So that you've developed, if you could explain very quickly, an enzyme capsule.
Yes. Some years ago, I suggested to Dr. John Pangborn, who's a brilliant chemist and the father of an autistic kid, that maybe we ought to develop a digestive enzyme that could be added to food before a child eats it, or give it to the child before the child eats a meal, that would digest those peptides that are causing problems, the casein and gluten peptides. And John worked on it for about 5 years. And finally, there is in the market now, there are three different brands, actually, three companies. Kirkman Labs has one, And Clear Labs has another, and there's a third company which has sort of pirated the idea. So I won't mention their name.
Yeah. This is not a substitute for the diet. This is to protect the child if they're not a not.
Yeah, it's very difficult to enforce the diet. Sometimes an autistic kid will grab a cracker crumb off the floor. His brother's eating a soda cracker, and a crumb drops to the floor, and the kid gets that little bit of wheat, and that's all. It's enough. That's enough to send him off to for several days because tiny amounts. Or the mother will buy a hamburger at a McDonald's or someplace, and they'll
God forbid.
Well, some people do, yeah. And often, very many do, and there will be some bun will be stuck to the burger, and yeah. The kid will get that little bit of...
Yeah, but they shouldn't be feeding kids burgers from anyway, but that's a whole other... Yeah, we can go on for an hour on that. But the point is, too, I think that these things work best in families where the whole family goes on the diet, honestly, and it doesn't hurt anybody to eat a hunter-gather-style diet. Everybody seems to do better. Before we run out of time, I want to talk about secretion, and then I want to go on to the vaccinations. So we've got about 5 minutes. So secretion is a surprise discovery.
It's secretin.
Secretin, and I'm saying it completely wrong. Surprise, surprise. So tell us about that.
Well, this secretin is the first hormone that was discovered. It was discovered in 1901. It's a digestive hormone that the body uses to help process food. And it was given to a child in New Hampshire, a friend of ours, as part of a medical diagnostic procedure. And the kid got better, and the mother started telling the doctor the kid got better, and he wouldn't believe her. So she went off and got some secretin herself and tried it on the kid, and her kid improved still further. Other people began to try it. And now a company in Massachusetts has... applied for FDA approval for the use of this hormone as a treatment for autism. There's been a lot of controversy about it. A number of studies have been done by people who seem to be intent on proving that it doesn't work. An awful lot of research is done by people whose minds are made up, as you know.
Yes.
And they do the research to demonstrate the correctness of their thinking rather than discover what the truth may be. But anyway, the FDA has recently given fast-track approval status to secretin, which means that even the FDA, which is not considered a very progressive organization, has found the evidence to be sufficiently persuasive that secretin, which is given primarily by injection, by the way, or infusion, you stick a needle in the kid's arm with some secretin every 3 to 5 weeks. They also have transdermal secretin, where you can mix it with a carrier, like DMSO or something, and rub it into the kid's skin. That doesn't seem to be quite as effective. So various ways of administering it, but a good percentage of autistic children will improve on this. Hopefully the company, Repligen Company in Massachusetts, will be able to put it on the market perhaps by the end of the year when their clinical trials are completed. It's a promising development.
And there's a website for that, too. It's secretin.com, if you want to go to that website. Now, at last, tell us the heavy metal contamination and vaccine story, if you would.
Well, it's much too long a story to get into it here. But a nurse, Lynn Redwood in Atlanta, read someplace about the FDA saying that there was too much mercury in vaccines and things. And also contact lens solution and other kinds of things. So she calculated how much mercury her child had received in one day when he received a whole bunch of vaccines. I think he was given 9 vaccines in one day. He became autistic shortly thereafter. And she found that her child, in that one day, had been given 125 times as much mercury as the Environmental Protection Agency considers to be the amount on a microgram per kilogram basis that an adult should receive. 125 times as much. And so she began looking into the matter, and she and a number of other people began publishing on it. And there have been investigations. Congressman Burton, Dan Burton of Indiana, by the way, has a grandson who's autistic. And his grandson became autistic shortly after getting 9 vaccines. Not 9, let's see. I've forgotten how many vaccines. But anyway, 40 times. 40 times as much mercury in one day as the Environmental Protection Agency considers the maximum allowable amount.
I don't think people can get the vaccines without the mercury either, well, so it's a real problem for parents.
Well, as of about a year and a half ago, the FDA ordered them to stop manufacturing those vaccines containing that preservative.
Good.
However, they are allowing them to continue to use the stuff on the shelves. And there's an enormous backlog of stuff on doctors' shelves, refrigerators, and in warehouses and so forth. You probably read where they discovered a 40-year-old batch of smallpox vaccine.
Oh, Jesus.
And they make them in huge batches. So anyway, a number of people, including myself and Lynn Redwood, the nurse I mentioned earlier, are trying to get the FDA to, in fact, I visited the FDA in late February, to try to talk them into requiring that all those vaccines be taken off the shelves.
Yeah.
But they're not doing it.
Well, the issue of vaccinations is a very difficult one. There are several books out there. There is a good book by Via, Jill Romm, R-O-M-M, called something like Vaccinations, A Parent's Guide, which talks about heavy metals and mercury and stuff. So, and gives gives you information so you can make some informed decisions about vaccines. Anyway, we're just completely out of time. If people want an information packet from the Autistic Research Institute, you can, if you are low in cash, you can just send them, you know, just write them and ask for a packet. If you can afford a donation, that would be helpful. It's ARI 4182 Adams Avenue, San Diego, ADAMS Adams, San Diego, 92116. Dr. Bernard Rimland, RIMLAND, PhD, thank you very much for your work.
It's been my great pleasure.
It always is a pleasure to interview you. Good luck with everything you're doing. And people can also, the website is the AutismResearchInstitute.com. So thanks again.
Keep up the good work.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or if you need a cassette copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows, go to the website. It's yourownhealthandfitness.com. Yourownhealthandfitness.com. Next week, I'll be back with a show with a psychiatrist, Dr. Frederick Schiffer, author of Two Minds, and we'll be reviewing some new research out of the NIH and Harvard that supports his dual brain theory of personality and treatment for depression. The engineer of Your Own Health and Fitness here in Sebastopol is George Curtis at the Powerhouse Brewery. Thank you to Johnny Otis in the Powerhouse. And at KPFA, Lisa Ballard. I'm Lena Berman. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced live by Free Speech Radio, When My Mouth Works, and beyond. May it live forever, KPFA 94.1 FM, Berkeley, California, and I'll be back next week.